Welcome to Chevron's Lock the Stargate podcast. I'm Chelsea.
I'm Jess.
And I'm Melanie.
This episode is a very special episode where we will be discussing the Fandemonium book Sacrifice Moon by Julie Fortune. It is our first book club podcast. We hope you guys enjoy it, in which case we will do more. And it, as usual, will have spoilers. We'll be probably talking about this book in the context of the whole series, as well as explicit content. And the book is kind of heavy and adult themed anyway. So yeah. Regardless of what tactics we take to talk about it, it could be pretty explicit. So be forewarned. This book and this episode, there is some discussion about suicide because it happens in the book. So please be warned for that before engaging with us in this episode.
Yes. We don't really have, like, a plan. We're just going to, like, talk about this book as if you were chilling with us, get a glass of wine, and, like, have a girls' book club. Oh, or guys' book club. This is an inclusive book club.
We're basically winging it, guys. We have no idea.
Yeah, we're winging it. We read this book. We like this book. Well, I like this book. And we're going to talk about it. It's going to be great.
I would like to offer a disclaimer.
Yes.
That we don't speak Greek.
No, God. Oh, y'all.
And I did try to do research on how to pronounce some of these words. And basically what I found is that there were like four different pronunciations for most of them. So we're going to do our best.
We'll get creative. We'll be like that one guy in that one robe. We'll just avoid the names altogether.
I think we should all just pronounce them all differently, just to see how we all try to pronounce them in our heads. I'm ready for this.
I've read three different translations of the Odyssey, and they all spelled all the names differently. So I feel like we're okay if we pronounce it a little wrong.
I think you'll be right.
Yes.
All right. So
let's talk about, hey, what was this book even about, guys? Let's give a quick...
Do you want to do a brief synopsis?
Super brief. We're not going to go too much in depth here about the plot. We assume that you've read the book. And then if you haven't read the book, maybe you're not here for like a play-by-play. Maybe you're only here just to learn if there's shippy moments or what is actually in this book.
Or team building moments. Yeah. Or,
so yeah. Like the general gist of this book, I would say, is SG-1. So first of all, this book starts, it's set right after Enemy Within.
4 days after Kowalski dies.
Yes. So everything is very fresh. This is like a brand new team, brand new SG-1. This is one of their first missions. They get sent to essentially this kind of Greek-esque or Roman-esque, some kind of one of those planets. And and there's some stinky shit going on. There's a couple politician guys who are being a little dodgy as they are. Mm-hmm. And SG-1 decides they're gonna bounce because there's no signs of Goa'uld around. There's no signs of Share. That's their whole point. They're gonna leave. Turns out a sneaky dude is being sneaky for a reason. They get thrown through the Stargate into a different planet. And essentially on this planet, when they wake up, there's collars around their necks. There's other people on this planet. And as the story progresses, Daniel and Sam progressively become more predatory and hunter-like. And Teal'c and Jack, their collars remain white. Daniel's and Sam's start turning black. And Teal'c and Jack stay normal. Although it is posited that perhaps they are in some way being weakened or
made less aggressive as
prey, essentially. And along the way, we meet different people who have been thrown on this planet and are surviving the best they can. And we learn that the planet is being ruled by a Goa'uld who is calling herself Artemis. And SG-1 teams up with some of the other survivors of this planet to take out Artemis and return home happily ever after. Is the, I would say, general gist of the story.
Reader's Digest condensed version.
Very condensed.
Very condensed version.
As we kind of get into what we liked and disliked about what we learned about the characters, particularly because Sam and Daniel get kind of put in as these hunter, aggressive kind of characters, and then Jack and Teal'c are kind of themselves, essentially. So as we get through, you'll learn more about how these collars affected them and highlighted or lessened their personalities. But that's the general gist of it, I would say. Did I leave anything out?
I mean, Yes, but I think you got a good
gist. I mean, you condensed it like you wanted to.
I mean, I meant leaving things out crucial to the summary. I think that's.
I mean, they defeated. Oh yeah, they Artemis. They defeat... If we like need to like add that part in, I don't know if that's important or not.
Well,
but...
they kind of defeat Artemis. She's stuck in a sarcophagus.
Yeah, she's trapped in a sarcophagus.
Yeah, well, I mean, I would consider that defeated.
Yeah, she's defeated-ish.
Defeated-ish.
And, yeah. Okay, that's all you need to know. Read the book if you want to know more.
Yeah, so I think we're going to, I think, just go ahead and jump in with some of the feedback we got from you guys. We got an email from Mary, and she said that, so we're just going to maybe take this bit by bit because we think there's some interesting things to talk about here. So she says, I really enjoyed this book, like truly did. I thought all the characterizations were pretty spot on, and I love early team chemistry. There was banter, there were jokes, it was all lovely. Why don't we, that's kind of a breaking point. I absolutely agree. I love that. I think Julie Fortune does a good job of capturing the characters' voices pretty well in this book, especially early seasons, and really shows them establishing their dynamics. We get some great exchanges that are lacking in the show, honestly, like Daniel and Sam building their camaraderie. We get like the Teal'c Daniel exchange.
I think you actually brought that up in a previous episode, how you wanted that to happen, and it never did, and now you have it in the book.
Yeah.
Yep. Yes. So actually, if we're gonna be talking about team dynamics, Jackie also talked about how she loved the team dynamics in this show. She says that the conversation between them, so basically Daniel and Teal'c have a conversation because Daniel has decided to go asking people if they've seen Sharae. He's like showing her picture around this planet. And Teal'c sort of goes to supervise him in doing this, and they end up having a conversation about what happened when Sharae was taken, and Teal'c tells Daniel that he was the one who took Sharae and selected her, and Daniel basically absolves him of any guilt or responsibility for that.
He blames himself.
Yes, he blames himself and not Teal'c, and also acknowledges that Teal'c was a slave when he did what he did. And he also says that he doesn't want Teal'c's guilt. He wants his help, which is just, man, it's a beautiful moment between those two. And he ends up calling him his brother, which I think is so beautiful between these two guys. When you think of like Teal'c, who was raised as a slave and had to betray all of his former brothers in arms, and Daniel, who was an orphan and raised in the system. And we know that that was not a super great. He didn't belong or felt like he belonged.
Right.
So I think that was a great moment.
I love that moment so much. I like that Daniel blames himself. Like, that kind of makes it, like, it adds a layer to, like, his kind of desperation to find her. Like, obviously, that's his wife and he loves her. But also, there's this, like, I have to go get Sharae back to kind of absolve myself. And that's the only way I can rest. I don't understand why this scene didn't get written into an episode. I feel like this absolutely 100% should have been addressed. It's a beautiful scene. They could have just like hired Julie Fortune, who, if you don't know, is the pen name for Rachel Kane, who's from Texas, holla. I have no idea why this wasn't part of an episode, because I feel like that's an essential thing.
I mean, maybe it got left on the cutting room floor. I feel like it's something that they might have. Well, I'm going to scratch that whole thought.
I did love getting it here. I wish we had seen this almost this exact same moment portrayed. I mean, on screen, it would have been great to have. But I did enjoy it here as well.
Yeah. And you kind of bring up too, like, we talk about Daniel being an orphan. I feel like this book did, you know, this book did more for Daniel's character and my appreciation of Daniel as a character than like the entire show. Like, I feel like I got this insight that Daniel just so desperately wants to belong to this team that because he's an orphan, because he kind of bounced around and it was always kind of the outsider, that there's this extra like longing to be part of SG-1 as more than just a team, but as a family. Like, he really wants it to work. And there were so many moments in this book when he talked about just that, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Also, we actually get in his head and hear, like, he doesn't actually value his own life. And that, yes, that's part of why he's so reckless. And the reason he jumps into dangerous situations is because it goes through his head and says that that's how he got attention, mm-hmm, when he was younger, mm-hmm, was just by putting himself in the middle of things. And it really does, it adds heartbreaking perspective to some of those things about Daniel that usually kind of irk us, where we're like, Daniel, what the hell are you doing? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's like, no, he legit doesn't value his own life. And it's sad. It's so tragic. And in the book, Sam basically is like, knock that shit off. I, yeah, value your life. Like,
yeah,
stop it.
Yeah. And what it makes it even harder because, okay, so if you haven't read the book, so the way that SG-1 ultimately overcomes, so they're, SG-1 are all wearing these collars, right? And the collars only come off in death. And while they're wearing these collars, Artemis, the Goa'uld on this planet, essentially is controlling them in some way or the other. Not like by mind control, or, I mean, kind of by mind control, but because of the way the collars are affecting them, they're not themselves. And so Daniel's plan is to essentially kill themselves.
Sam and Daniel
to kill themselves on the hopes that there is a sarcophagus. Like, there's some intel, there's a sarcophagus in this temple that they're going to. And the plan is kill ourselves. Jack and Teal'c will just bring us the sarcophagus, and hopefully that'll work, because once we're dead, they can take the collar off.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but I do think that's a fair plan, and they do make a valid argument. What else are you going to do? How else are you going to get the collars off? I mean, you can't fight the battle on two fronts. You can't fight Daniel and Sam, and you can't fight Artemis at the same time.
Okay, but the Black Company, or the Dark Company, whatever it was called, which is a group of, like, a hunter-survivor, mm-hmm, who, they have some of the prey people among them. They have a whole system about, like, locking up the prey people so they're safe. But the hunter people have a kind of slim control over themselves. They seem, like, semi-rational. It's not a perfect system, but they seem like they have at least a system. They were doing fine. Maybe SG-1 could have wrangled up.
But they were still killing people.
And Daniel made a good point that they're not really living.
Yes.
I mean, you're sitting there and you're locking up your loved ones, yeah, to save them from yourself.
Yeah, and Jack has a good line, too, about, like, because what's her face?
Which one?
I wanted to call her Pelop, so that's her
name. No, not Bernice. What's her name?
Brissice?
I can't call her Bernice.
I'm going to call her Brissice.
I can't call her Bernice in my head. Whatever. The wife who's pregnant, Jack tells, yes, her, like, do you really want to have your husband, like, go out and killing, washing his hands off with his blood, and then potentially killing, like, the son that he held during the day? So that's a fair point, I guess.
No, there are fair points, but I also feel like it was a weird balance for me, because on the one hand, I understood where Jack was coming from, because he knows what it's like to have blood on your hands, and he doesn't want that for Sam and Daniel, especially for Sam and Daniel, because they're the ones in their team who maybe haven't felt that yet.
Yes, he talks about that a lot.
But I also feel like he's casting a lot of judgment on this Dark Company who's just trying to make the best of a terrible situation. Like, I understand it's one thing for him to not want that for Sam and Daniel, but he's, like, so judgmental of, like, oh, they're washing murder off of their hands the next day. And it's like, yeah, they just, like, that's their only choice. It's that or die.
Yeah.
And they also are helping to take care of the ones they left behind. Like, they do go out and hunt and bring back food and stuff for the people they leave behind. And they have this whole little culture that they're trying to build. And like I said, I understood Jack's position, but I also felt like he was being a little judgmental of these people who were all victims.
Yeah, I also think it doesn't help that there were a lot of children being involved.
Yeah.
So one of the survival groups that they run into, there's an older man who's got, like, essentially an army of orphans who are half starved. And this guy, Loperotomy, I don't know what his name is.
Leonides.
Anyways, but he's using these orphans. So Jack's pretty pissed that these orphans are being used to lure innocent people in. And then when Daniel does die, y'all, talk about, remember how upset we were in Cold Lazarus about the Charlie thing? So there's a line, It's on page 189. And he says, "For a hard, horrible second, all Jack could think of with Daniel's limp, warm weight in his arms was the name of his son, Charlie, 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 chanted over and over inside his head in a keening wail. He couldn't look at Daniel's dead face. He just sat holding him until he heard the soft metallic click of the collar coming open around his neck." Freaking fuck! Like,
that's so rough, guys.
Poor the book Jack. Is so good.
So you brought up, so I'm kind of going backwards a little bit.
That's okay, and we're bouncing all
we're
around.
Not going, we're, yeah, we're
yeah,
talking.
I know. But so, like, going back to their plan and how Daniel wanted them to commit suicide to get the collars off, right? So Jack is, you know, obviously, like, way against this plan. Like, he thinks it's a horrible plan, doesn't want to do it, whatever. So basically, Daniel said, you know, Jack is arguing with Daniel and Sam, and Daniel goes, "You can't save us."
Yeah.
And she can't control us once the collars are off.
Yeah.
And then, you know, he still doesn't like it. Mm-hmm. And then Sam says, "Sir, please, I can't let her do this to me. I'd rather be dead, even if you can't bring me back. Last night I tried to murder a child."
Yeah.
Yeah. So she basically says she'd rather be dead than murder a child, and she knows that he would too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Which is very true. Like,
yep. And that whole scene too, I know we're bouncing around, guys. This is kind of how I envision, like, when we're talking about book club, by the way, that this is going to go. Like, we're just talking about, like, the things that we liked and the things that stood out to us. So sorry if this is too scatterbrained for y'all, but
I've also never done a book club. This is my first, like,
this
ever
is
book
how
club
all
ever.
Book clubs I've so... ever been.
Yes, same here. This is how all book clubs go. You kind of just start talking and then you just start, "Oh yeah, and that one time and that one place." But so Sam talks about she almost killed a child, and I really I think it was I want to call her Wacky Jacks. I've been calling her Jackie or Wacky Jacks. I don't know what to call her.
Her name is Jackie.
Call her Jackie.
We'll call her Jackie. So Jackie emailed us too, which, thank you, Jackie. You sent in a lot of really good points. But one of your points was that you didn't think that there was tons of super shippy moments, which I totally see where you're coming from. And there was, like, allusions to, like, friendship and camaraderie. I just chose to put my ship goggles on instead. But I found this scene where she tried to kill a child really, like, tension-filled. And, like Sam is begging Jack to, like, help her and control her and, like, tie her up. And look, I'm not saying anything other than the scene could be read a lot of ways.
Well, and I think it's also worth noting that at that point in the story, Sam's gemstone thing was all the way black.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone they talked to said that it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. People have killed their wives, their children, their parents.
Yep.
They lose all reason. And yet, Jack manages to get Sam to drop her weapon.
Yep.
Not just drop her weapon. So he convinces her to not shoot him.
Yep.
And then she shoots a guy who's about to attack Jack.
Yep.
And then drops her weapon and surrenders to Jack.
Yep.
And based on everything we've seen, that is, like, unprecedented for everybody on this planet.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that this early on, I mean, again, they've been a team for, like, 2 weeks, that they have that close of a bond, and that his... Because he is her commanding officer, that his orders, I think it must be at least, if you don't want to put the shipper goggles on, at least partly some of her training of commanding officer is giving me orders.
Yeah.
But it's also very emotional and heartbreaking because she's just begging him to not let her hurt anybody.
I mean, she, like, sinks to her knees and puts her hands behind her head and, like, is in complete surrender mode. And she can barely talk. And she says, "Help." And he says, "How? Tie me." And he says, "No, you have to be able to move." And she says, "I can't." And he says, "You will. You will. That's an order." She wailed inside wordlessly. The moonlight burned like acid and her shudders got worse. She felt a small tortured moan work its way free and felt her eyes flood again with helpless raging tears. "Help me." He was helping her. He wasn't running.
Yeah.
So fucking good.
It is. It's really good. Well, and then we find out, so what had happened at this, like, so at this point, Sam and Daniel had basically been let loose to go on the hunt with the rest of the Dark Company, and Jack and Teal'c had to escape the confinement of the Prey people to go help Daniel and Sam. And Jack goes after Carter, and Teal'c goes after Daniel. And Jack, it's important to note, is injured, has a very severe ankle injury, And he's still, so Teal'c even notes it. And
yes,
when we get Teal'c's point of view, he basically says that Jack gave him an example of endurance and self-sacrificing because he went after Carter, even though she's more dangerous than Daniel and he's injured.
Yep.
And then Jack has to sit. So he gets Carter and he gets her under control, but he has to sit and listen to this firefight that's happening with Teal'c and Daniel and not be able to go intervene, which we all know is like the worst thing that Jack could have to endure because he is taking care of Carter. Yep. And keeping her there and steady and under control.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Which he does by eye contact.
Again, I can see how you don't want to put your shipper goggles on, but if you want to...
I mean, there's a lot of flirty stuff too. I mean, early on, can we talk about the early exchanges at the beginning?
Yes.
Like
at the
very, yes, the please.
Best.
Like before they even go on their mission, on like the briefing.
The bet thing was the greatest.
Yes.
I love it. So great. Love it.
So Jack and Siler have a bet on when Carter's going to show up to the briefing. And
no,
Jack...
it's Daniel.
No.
Oh, no, it was Siler.
So it starts with Siler and Jack. Having a bet that Carter will be the first person to the briefing.
Oh, yeah.
And Daniel was there first, if I remember right.
No, Sam was there first.
Sam was there first. Oh.
So Sam was first.
I read this long ago, guys. It was a long time ago.
Sam was first. And
so Jack gets $20 from Siler.
Yes.
And then Sam sees it.
Yes. And then Sam bets Jack that Daniel will be at the
meeting. Will be there within 2 minutes.
Yeah.
She says.
Yeah. And Jack says, that's no right. way. Like, you're on.
Daniel shows up at the last second, comes running in and says, am I late? And Sam is like, nope, you're right on time. And like holds her hand out to Jack for the money. Says her hand was out, fingers wiggling significantly.
Yes.
And then we find out that... the reason Daniel is, because Jack's like, the hell, dude, you're never on time for things. And he's like, oh, well, Captain Carter gave me a watch and put an alarm on it. Which is great. Also, I do have to say, this is just a very small and random nitpick, but because we're talking about Daniel and the watch and the time, when they say 1400 hours, he says he doesn't know what that is. And I take issue with that because he's an archaeologist who we know has spent time abroad. And in most other countries, they use a 24-hour timetable for at least things like bus schedules and things. Like, he would know what 1400... I would assume.
Oh, I totally agree. Doesn't he say it in the show as well?
I mean, I think so. I don't know if this early in the show he said it.
This book was published in 06.
Yeah, before Hunger Games... it's got major Hunger Games vibes.
Yeah,
for sure.
It does.
It's like tributes killing each other, the death fruit leaves.
So there was another part that I kind of thought was kind of flirty, and I kind of liked it. So to start it off, Jack doesn't get a memo.
Yeah.
And so Jack's kind of like, Daniel, do you have my memo? And Daniel's like, yeah, I couldn't find your office. Which I find hilarious because nobody knows where his office is.
Which he doesn't want people to know where it is.
Exactly. So he says that he doesn't know where it is, and Jack says, good, let's keep it that way. Jack flicked the memo to the across the table with a fingernail towards Carter, who fielded it and put it on her own folder. Captain, as my second in command, you're the keeper of the paperwork. And next time, a little pre-mission briefing, okay? Absolutely, Colonel. Was that a smile? Nah. Couldn't be.
Which, speaking of smiles, boy, does Jack notice her smile a lot. We get a lot of her luminescent smile, her blindingly bright smile. A lot of talk about how great Sam's smile is.
Yeah.
Can you blame him?
I mean, God, no.
Yeah, there's also... hang on, now I'm just trying to find my Sam and Jack notes. I mean, there's a lot of him, like, noticing her... her capabilities. He notices we note when we watch the show that she's always at the ready. And so even when he's like giving her the order to be ready, he notices that she's already ready.
Yeah.
There is one line where he says when they get to the planet and Daniel and Sam are just so excited about everything they see, he notes, Carter was fascinated. looking everywhere at once, taking in more than Jack would probably ever see if he spent a week with a camera.
I like that there's a, especially in the earlier parts of the book, there's a great balance between Sam the scientist and Sam the military officer. And I appreciate that because I think that sometimes the show struggles with balancing those things. Hang on, I'm going to kill my cat. One second. So I think the show struggles sometimes with, like, the role they want her to play. And I think it's easier in a book to point those things out when she's being sciencey versus, like, okay, now we're going to say that she's got some steel in her voice when she's being a military second in command. But I like those moments of, like, when there's a line or there's a scene where Sam and Daniel are geeking out over some of the ruins. And Sam kind of has to, like, rein him back in. And there's a notation that it's, like, you could hear her be a little more professional and, like, a little more stern with him. Like, okay, it's time to stop geeking out and, like, focus again.
Yeah. So I actually specifically noted that moment partly because, so this is after they've been sent to the second planet and things are a little more dire, but also Jack is hurt and he sends Carter back. And it's almost like he's testing her of, like, is she going to geek out or is she going to rein him in? And I just thought it was interesting that when Jack's hurt, she's not having it. Like, all other times, she's right there with Daniel, ready to get excited. And when she comes back, he says, nice Daniel wrangling. Of course, you're still new at it. He's being polite. It'll get tougher.
That's so great.
It's one of the times that he makes her laugh, too.
Which is, you know, it happens.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, like, Jack is hurt in this book. Pretty terribly. Like, his ankle is essentially, I mean, I don't know if it's broken, but it's torn to hell, and there's maybe a torn ligament. It's swollen inside of his boot. He can barely walk, and he, like, ranks it on his, like, Jack pain scale.
I love that he has Jack a pain scale. I love it.
Debilitation.
Yes.
And by the end of the book, like, he ranks it like an 8, which is, like, you know, he jokes that he's, like, going for a record or something.
So I was just going to say, his pain scale is a 6 is where he can soldier on effectively. An 8 is the blown knee he had on his first parachute drop. And 9 is a Baghdad prison. And 10, he's probably dead.
Yeah. So by the end of the book, homeboy's at an 8. So he's a little sore. But I thought there were some, like, serious solitudes vibes. I know this is set pre-solitudes. But, like, Sam is, I guess the resident medic, because she's the one who kind of, like, checks him out and, like, thinks about giving him medicine. And I just thought it was interesting that maybe Sam is, like, the designated. Oh, here we go. Captain, how are your first aid skills? Depends on if it's sprained, broken, or needs amputation, sir. Not that Carter looked to be any prize herself in the health sweepstakes. He kept sweeping her with looks, trying to see where the blood on her face had come from. No visible wounds. She crouched at his side with a kit and manipulated his ankle with ruthless disregard for the sounds of protest he made. Daniel stood watching, arms crossed, frowning tensely. Not broken, sir, she finally said. You should probably keep the boot on, otherwise the swelling's going to be worse. Best I can do is anti-inflammatories and pain pills, and you should try to stay off of it. Which is, oh, not going to happen, Captain. She was digging through the kit. Just the anti-inflammatories. I'll dope up once we're back home. So, and she then proceeds to give him a rundown on the supplies they have. Yeah. So, it was very solitude-y to me.
Yeah, it definitely had a solitude's vibe. I take issue a little bit with the fact that she was able to diagnose it as not a fracture without taking his boot off. Like, medically, it's the right choice not to take his boot off, but it would be hard to tell for sure whether or not there was a break without taking it off.
Yeah, just ruthless manipulation.
I feel like Jack would have known if it was broken, though.
Jack would have been
I mean, hey.
Maybe Jack's not a very reliable source of pain.
That's also true, since his pain scale is like a 9.
Yeah,
that's fair. Does someone talk about team dynamics? Have we already talked about that?
No, we can keep talking. We kind of bounce around.
Oh no, because I flipped back to page 11.
Okay.
When they're sitting in the the place where they eat food, and Jack's just sitting there watching Sam and Daniel talk, and I like it because he's just sitting back and watching, like, them interact and watching and seeing how Teal'c interacts. And he thinks, like, you know, this might actually work.
Yeah.
And then he felt something that had been clenched like a fist inside of him since he'd seen Charles Kowalski die. Slowly relax. It took time to build a team. Time and trust and respect. and he sipped his coffee and was content to listen. Mm-hmm. So yeah. I just think that's really cool that he just, like, sat back and listened and just watched.
I think it's Jackie who brought up that there's this opening scene here where they're, I think she referenced them drinking in the pub-ish place on the planet that they go to. Mm. But this works too, because the book ends with the team getting drinks and having pitchers of beer and talking and talking and just not stopping talking. Mm-hmm. So it's like a good full circle. Like, we're starting with Jack leaning back and just listening and watching the team form. And by the end of the book, everyone's talking and they are a team.
Yeah. Yeah. It was Jackie who noted. And she did. She mentioned the commissary scene and then the final scene.
Yeah.
In the bar. Yeah. I agree, Mel, with what you're talking about the team. We get a lot of them kind of sussing each other out here. And, like, there's a lot of Jack observing them and even doing the bet with Sam. Like, that was part of him kind of testing the waters of, like, okay, how military strict are you? Do you have a giant stick up your butt, or can we, like, play a little bit? And, you know, so her then taking the bait and joining in on the bet with him was like a good sign for him and their dynamic. And it's really fun to watch the Daniel Sam dynamic from Jack's perspective, because it's like, on the one hand, he's annoyed but when they geek out, but he also is really glad that they're bonding.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there's a progression of, so Daniel calls Sam Captain Doctor for most of the first several chapters, mm-hmm. but then he finally starts calling her Sam by the end of the book. And I think it's pretty great, because we do see him, I think, really only one more time call her to Captain Doctor on the show in Cold Lazarus when the face shows up in the crystal. But I think it's also, it's part of, it really helps demonstrate that this team still doesn't know what she is. Is she more right. scientist? Is she more military? Like, what, who is she in? And they're all, I think she's the biggest question mark on the team. Like, Teal, they don't know it all, but he at least is pretty steady. They know what they can expect from him.
Right. There's that kind of is like a good theme too, because when we get Jack's point of view when he's with Sam, that's a lot of his thoughts. Like, on page 94, he says, this is when Carter is kind of going through, her collar is turning dark and something just seems off. And Jack says, she'd been very quiet today, talking in monosyllables when spoken to. He couldn't gauge her. Was it just that the little voice in her head was louder and she was convinced this was a waste of time? Or when it came down to brass tacks, did Captain Carter not have what it took to carry on in the face of overwhelming odds? No, he had better instincts than that. Carter was okay. She'd hold together. If he'd ever misjudged anybody on that score, it had been a geeky, sneezy scientist on a mission to Abydos who'd ended up saving his ass. So something's wrong, and he's not sure if it's his assessment of her or if something is actually wrong. Mm-hmm. And then talk about shipper goggles. A couple pages later, they're kind of joking about how Sam only ever had eyes for flying. And Jack says, who in their right mind doesn't like flying? Army, Navy, and Marines, sir. And there's a reason that they're not on my team, Captain. I believe I did qualify it with right mind. She gave him a smile then. The uncomplicated approval of it eased some of the tension that had accumulated in his guts. Maybe she hadn't been acting odd after all. Maybe that black spot on the necklace had nothing to do with it. And, oh, that was it. So, I mean, I'm just saying, the uncomplicated approval of it eased some of the tension that had accumulated in his guts.
I'm just saying.
That's something.
So, with talking about the flying and the Army, Navy, Marines, whatever, which isn't totally true. There's flying in the other branches as well.
Yeah.
But I did like when Jack, so at one point, Teal'c was not sufficiently hiding behind their cover. And Jack says to him, you want to present a big, easy target? Join the Marines. In the Air Force, we duck.
Yeah. Man, I gotta say, I also really like the way, speaking of Teal'c, I love the way that he got written in this book, because when he was being like really physical, like, especially in the beginning, talking about how, like, athletic and graceful and, like, strong Teal'c was. Like, I think especially, I mean, we've talked about this before in other episodes, that Teal'c kind of gets left in the background. But I felt like in the book, even though he was in the background, he was still being appreciated. So, like, he was scouting ahead and he was, like, moving around the perimeter. And, like, there was still keeping him in in scene and like reminding us that he's like a not just a big guy, but like a strong guy.
Yeah. Well, and they Jack mentions multiple times how sneaky he is, like he sneaks up behind them and they didn't notice how just what basically what a good soldier he is.
Yeah. Okay. So there's speaking of Teal'c, so we don't get tons of Teal'c info in season one, but there's a great Teal'c and Sam moment when Teal'c is tying up Sam for the night because she can't be trusted because she's going to go kill people. And Teal'c says, "I do not wish to fight you," he said with unexpected gentleness. "Whether you wish to fight me is a thing you must decide for yourself." Sam flinched, blinked, and looked away. "I, too, have felt the heat of battle. It is a seductive thing. Jaffa are trained to resist because we must follow the orders of our masters without question. There are meditative techniques. Tonight, I will teach you." I just felt like that was a good, like, Teal'c Sam bonding moment.
It is.
It is.
And that we, like, learn about Teal'c.
Yeah.
And we learn that it took him 100 years to rebel against Apophis.
Yeah.
So Teal'c's 100 in season one, guys.
Yeah. I thought it was also interesting at the beginning. We get Hammond saying that what their mandate from the president is.
Oh, what page is that on?
I don't know.
Oh, it's at okay. the beginning.
I don't know.
He says, "The mandate from the president, perform reconnaissance, assess any threats that may exist, and make people peaceful contact with these people." And then he notes that if there are no Goa'uld present on this planet, that may be some indication of that they have defeated them or have some possible deterrent that we could investigate. Which, so then later when Jack is like, "Well, they don't have Share, they don't have Goa'uld, let's bounce." I'm like, dude, you've been there 6 hours and there was evidence that they had maybe overthrown Goa'uld. Mm-hmm. And I get it. Jack's like bullshit radar was going off. That's right. Really why he wanted to leave.
Right.
But I was also like, these people might legitimately, I mean, it turned out they didn't, but it did seem to me like this might be worth investigating.
Well, they kind of did.
Sort of. I mean,
like yes, in the, like in
by
this,
giving her human sacrifice.
Yeah, like in the sense that there were gold around on another planet near yeah. that they like. Oh, are we going to talk about in relation to that? So we're learning things like about the SGC and like so we, now we have a mandate apparently that was never really spoken about in the show until much later. But we also learn there's like protocols in place. Like Jack, one of the plot points is that Jack knows that if they don't make contact with the SGC, another SG team will come through and they will search for SG-1. We learn that
Dixon is in charge of SG-2.
Dixon is in charge of SG. Does SG-2 die in the show?
There are multiple SG-2s and Dixon is not in charge of SG-2 when we see him again much yeah. later on. He's SG-13, I think.
Oh. You have a much better memory of that than I did. I thought it was interesting, too, that, like, Dixon's, like, kind of a shit eater and just, like, oh, no, there was some problems getting back to the SGC. We had to stick around and make sure you were okay. And that...
Well, and Jack knew he would do that. Yes,
because Dixon's a digger.
Yeah, so when they get back to the original planet at the end after they've escaped and they get back, instead of immediately going to the SGC, Jack, like, clicks onto his radio and he's like, "Dixon, you there, man?" Like, he knew that he would stick around and keep looking for them. And he's like, "How did you get away with not going back? Hammond should have recalled you." And he's like, "Oh, we couldn't. There was, yeah. like, a problem with Whoopsies. The DHT.
Wink, wink. Yeah, I thought it was interesting. And, like, on this planet, there's, like, that Stargate's used as, like, an airport. They keep calling it an airport. Uh-huh. And there's, like, families lined up to, like, use the Stargate to travel. I thought it was interesting. Like, I hadn't thought about, we hadn't seen on the show, like, a civilization using the Stargate that way.
No, not
we
really.
We do in 2010.
Yeah. We will in 20, yes, I meant, yeah. like, up until this point.
I'm just, you know, just that episode that you don't like.
Yeah, we're not talking about
yeah.
that.
Okay.
I'm going to be mysteriously sick. It's going to be Chelsea and Melanie no, you're only not. For 2010.
Shut up. So you have to watch 100 Days, too, so you have to just get ready.
Don't even listen. We have time before then.
So the reason that they don't just land on this hostile planet and immediately turn around and leave is that the DHD seems to be missing a crystal.
And oh, yeah.
So that's part of why they're going to, they think maybe it's at the Acropolis or the temple that's in the middle of the city. And so they're going there to defeat Artemis and hopefully find the crystals so they can get the hell off this planet. But also in there, they discover, so I don't know how canon this is considered, but we get a little bit of an explanation of why everybody speaks English.
Yes. Because they have a TARDIS.
Yeah, yeah, basically the DHD is a TARDIS.
Very Doctor Who-y.
Which is totally, I mean, I think it's a great explanation. I like it.
I mean, works for me. It's hand wavy. But so basically what happens is because they've always, so far they've traveled from just their Stargate to other places, they don't have a DHD. And so that program that like allows them to understand other people's languages doesn't work because they don't have a DHD. But when they went from Chalcis to, what's the other one called?
Does it have a name?
No, maybe not. It might just be the unnamed fifth planet.
Yeah, I think it's just an unnamed planet.
Because it's the fifth, there are four planets in the Confederation, and it's like the fifth planet that used to be in the Confederation. Yeah. But yeah, when they go there, they went from a planet with a DHD to another planet with a DHD, and they're able to then understand the people on that planet.
Yes.
So
I buy it.
Well, and so then Sam talk and Daniel have their geeking out moment where she's like, oh, maybe I can figure out what the program, the code is and like reverse engineer it to put it into their dialing mm-hmm. program. So we can maybe assume that she succeeded in doing that, which, by the way, would be fucking brilliant, like, if she managed
to pull that is out. Brilliant? Like, does that need any, like...
No, it's just it needs to be pointed out as often as possible.
I think Jackie pointed that out. She said, Jackie actually had an issue with it. She said, I appreciated Julie, the author, using the theory that the Stargate via the DHD translated languages, thus explaining that aliens wouldn't speak English argument, but there was no further detail as to how that worked. More than likely, it's because the team's knowledge of the Stargate and its technology was very primitive, but it's something that Jackie wanted to read more about. Which, hey, same. But I think for a hand-wavy explanation, I think it totally works. It's one of those, like...
Stellar drift is compensated by the DHD automatically.
Yeah. It's like, what is that, like, how, like,
black box?
There's something about, like, no, there's, like, a saying that's, like, don't think about how, like, Superman, like, drives or something. There's some saying about, like, when it comes to, like, sci-fi and fantasy, sometimes you don't want to dig too deep because it's, like, not that deep.
Don't let the facts get in the way of a good story.
Yeah.
Also, really, yeah, but try not to think too hard about...
But there's a Superman, really. I'm going to find it now.
It's going to drive me crazy. Google it now.
Hang on. Don't tug on Superman's cape.
Don't
tug the mask off the
old. It's like, range. Don't think about how Superman, like, washes his suit. Hang on. Don't think about how. Hang on. It's a thing.
I have never heard of this until just now.
I heard it from my ex, which maybe it's not a thing. Maybe it's just a thing that he said.
Your experiences are not universal.
Yeah, Jess. Jeez.
Hang on.
So while you're looking that up, I was just going to talk about how... So Sam has a moment of kind of almost expressing her jealousy to Daniel that he is a little further into the circle with Jack.
Yes.
That he's more on the inside. And Daniel tells her that Jack doesn't really share. And Sam says, well, you don't really share either. And he says, well, you don't either. So Sam is just like, I'll tell you whatever you want, and like spews out her life highlights, and it's pretty adorable. Like, you're gonna throw that at me? No, I'll tell you everything you want to know.
She kissed her first boy at 14. Okay, I can't find it. Maybe it's just a thing my ex used to say.
Is that so? She brought up kissing her first boy at 14, and I can't, I think I'm getting my shows mixed up. I feel like there was something that was said, like, about when she was, like, 16 or 17.
That's a fic.
Is it a fic?
I think it's a fic.
Shit.
I can't remember anything from the show.
This is what happens when I read too much fic. I can't differentiate the two. I don't have any idea what's happening. So, that's not true. Just gonna throw it out the window. Why? So... I noticed throughout the book, like, one of the running themes was that Sam was always, like, wondering why this was happening to her faster than it was happening to Daniel.
I love that.
Well, and why it was happening to her and not Jack.
Right, of course. And I just... How did y'all feel about that? I
felt for her so much.
Yeah.
Because I think all of us can relate to that. Like, that's... You would be questioning yourself... So hard, like, am I not mentally strong enough? Is there something defective inside me that makes me more susceptible to this? Like, that, I mean, the self-doubt that you would feel watching your, like, feeling yourself slip into this state while watching Jack and Teal'c be unaffected and Daniel be less affected.
Right.
Oh, man. I can't imagine. Although, I have a theory on this. It's the one that's kind of talked about in the book. But when they first get to this planet and learn that Artemis is the goddess there, Daniel talks about Artemis.
Mm-hmm.
And how she's like the goddess of the hunt and whatnot. And he talks about the story of Actaeon.
Mm-hmm.
So Actaeon was a hunter, a really renowned hunter. And he there's different versions of the story, but the most popular one, he accidentally saw Artemis naked. It wasn't even like creeping on her. He accidentally saw her naked, but then he like stopped to admire her beauty. She spotted him and she told him never to speak again or he would change into a deer. But then upon hearing his hunting dogs, he called to them and immediately transformed into a stag. So he started running into the woods, but his well-trained hunting dogs tracked him down and tore him to pieces. So he was killed by the dogs that he trained and who were loyal to him.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought that was kind of my explanation of what happened here is like Jack and Teal'c are hunters, like Actaeon. And they get turned into stags. And then, like, Sam and Daniel, who are these loyal, sweet, loving people, are turned on them, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was part of maybe what Artemis does, is she kind of picks the people who are hunters and turns them into stags. And picks the people who are, like, loyal, good, sweet, like, that it's going to destroy the most.
Mm-hmm.
And not that it wouldn't not, I mean, it's going to destroy most people.
Right.
And turns them into hunters. And that's posited. Daniel basically says the same thing. It's like a role reversal. Like people who are usually kind of more predatory are turned prey. And prey turned predator.
Yes.
Which isn't to say Teal'c and Jack are predators. But they are hunters. Like they're warriors. And
I mean, so Sam says, is it me? Is this happening to me first? Because she made a gesture with her hand, frustrated and vague. Wrong somehow? No, Sam. He says, Daniel says, I think it's random. If it were some kind of measure of violence, why not Teal'c? He's fought all his life. And Jack, God knows Jack's got plenty of experience at it. Why wouldn't it make them hunters? Why wouldn't it make them the hunters? Wouldn't they be better at it than the two of us? And Sam says, so maybe it goes against type? And then Daniel says, or maybe it just pulls on what we're afraid of. Teal'c and Jack might be just as afraid of being prey as we are of being predators? Exactly. Sam hesitates. Are you afraid? And Daniel says, some part of him wasn't afraid at all. He'd fought before when pushed to it, but he'd never gone looking for it. Maybe that had been self-preservation. He'd always been the new kid, the strange kid, the unwanted kid. He'd learned to take beatings, but never to give them. It was a darkly, liquidly seductive feeling, knowing that he was going to change that, and that he had no choice in the matter. That's some deep, like, going against everything that you think you are. Shit. Yeah. And I appreciate that Daniel is, and Sam to some extent, are like kind of seduced by it too. Like they want to. Like they want to go, which isn't like that they actually want to. The collar is making them want to go.
It's like an overpowering lust, I would want to say, almost.
Yeah.
Because like they almost lust to want to kill someone.
Yeah. Especially the way it's like written. It's kind of got these like sexual kind of overtones when they're like running and Daniel's admiring Sam's body. I mean, same. But
it almost plays like Twilight, like when she becomes a vampire.
Yeah.
And she's like running because it's like they're stronger and faster and fitter. And then there's like this call of the blood. Like, it legitimately read to me like Bella's first hunt.
Yeah. It's very sexual.
It's like a Twilight Hunger Games mashup.
It is.
Yeah. Finally, guys, if that's what you've been looking for, do we have the book for you? Someone tell all YA readers across the country.
Actually, real quick sidebar. So I was reading this last night at my indoor game.
Yes.
And one of my teammates saw it and she goes, oh, they have books? And I looked at her and I go, you watch the show? And she goes, yeah, I mean, I grew up with brothers and we watched it and it was good and da 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 da. And I was like, oh, that's really cool. And she goes, yeah, I sit under her books. And I was like, yeah. Yeah.
Melanie. I'm one of the... That's how you make Stargate friends. What do you mean? Yeah.
I'm awkward, Jess. Have you met me?
Did you ask if she had a Tumblr?
She definitely does not have a Tumblr.
What's the next step?
The next step.
But she did ask me why I was reading it, and I was like, oh, my friends and I have a podcast.
Oh, you admitted it. I see how. Okay, so let's get back to some of our email-y thoughts, because I think we're wandering around. Which, hey, that's what book club's about. We're just here to have a good time.
Yeah. So Mary said that she gave the whole theory about the gate somehow imparting a translation ability, a healthy side eye, and eyebrow raise. But I didn't dwell. I think that's the appropriate right response. Yeah.
Yes. Don't worry about how Superman... Man, what is the rest of that?
Just make up your own.
Yeah, make up your own.
You're saying like, now. It's like, don't worry about how Superman like inflates his tires or something. Or who inflates... Oh, no. It's who... Batman. It's who inflates the... Ah, I remember now. It's don't worry about who puts air into Batman's tires.
It's Alfred. It's Alfred.
But don't worry about it. Maybe it's not Alfred. Don't worry about it. Just know that the Batmobile is always perfectly serviced.
But it is Alfred.
But maybe it's not. I'm not saying it was... Look, there's a reason he's my ex. I said he was my ex. Okay, this is why I broke up with him. He had very stupid metaphors and analogies.
So Mary goes on to say, mostly this story gave me everything I wanted. Jack being an amazing leader, some early Sam and Jack adorableness, and the team working together and kicking ass and taking names. I have to say we should all be grateful that Sam uses her power for good, because I agree with that author and the writers of Replicator that if she ever turned to evil, she would be the most terrifying badass in the universe. So much agree with that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of Jack being a good leader, I liked the scene where the Black Company is first attacking them.
Oh, yeah.
SG-1's kind of out in the open. They're on their way to the Acropolis to go basically kick some Artemis ass. And so all of a sudden, arrows start flying at them. But they are all arrow after arrow hiss past him to shatter on a conveniently placed piece of fallen roof. Cover, Jack yelled, and bodily shoved Daniel towards them. Carter, down. He and Tilk weren't dropping, though. They were armed and deadly and scanning the ruined buildings facing across from them. Jack held his fire even when another volley of arrows cut the air, arched, and fell short. One slid to a stop at his feet. Jack? Daniel asked urgently, but Jack shook his head. They want to see what kind of firepower we've got. Otherwise, they'd have hit us already. Chess. It had surprised Daniel how good a player Jack was, but he supposed it shouldn't have. You didn't reach the exalted rank of colonel without having an advanced grasp of tactics.
Yes. Yes. That was great.
Mr. Chess Man Jack. Don't know where that thought was going.
No, it's a great tactical display for Jack.
Yeah.
That even in the heat of like having arrows run down on them, he keeps his wits about them to understand what exactly is happening.
I think Jack in this episode is a good leader. And we kind of commented on it when we were doing some of the early episode discussions about how we felt like those early episodes of Jack felt a little out of character, like like Emancipation, for example, which I think is around the corner based on where this book is. You know, Jack makes some questionable decisions. And I think Jackie points out in her review, she says, a couple of times I found myself thinking, Jack wouldn't fall for that so easily, or he wouldn't have slept through that. But I think they're doing the best they can considering where this book, when this book takes place in this series. And, you know, he makes his best judgment calls. I mean, he's trying to protect his team.
I do think though that a part of him sometimes in this book not being a good leader or sleeping through things or, you know, things that he normally wouldn't do is because of Artemis.
The collar?
Yeah, it's because of the collar. It makes, I don't want to say it makes him weaker, but it makes him more susceptible to...
being prey.
Yes.
It makes him slightly... because the moment that Daniel has as maybe realizing that perhaps Teal'c and Jack are also affected by it is that when Sam first takes off, like the very first time when she's gone sort of hunter crazy at night and Daniel chases after her, she comes back around and Jack stumbles upon her and she's about to shoot a guy who's seizing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Jack yells at her and tells her to stop, but then he doesn't do anything.
Yes.
Daniel comes in and knocks her gun up, prevents her from killing the guy, and then he, like, beats up Sam.
Yeah.
But and Jack eventually yells at Daniel to get him to stop, but Jack doesn't physically intervene.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Daniel later notes it and is like, that is not Jack. Like, he would have gotten involved.
Yep.
And that there was a little bit of hesitation maybe there that was perhaps unnatural for Jack and being forced on him. So yeah, I agree with Jackie that some of it does feel a little bit out of character for Jack, but I also agree with you, Mel, that I think that's part of what's happening because of the callers.
Totally.
I am going to also add in another part where I like Jack and his, like, leadership role. So when they get taken in by Leonidas,
mm-hmm.
And they start feeding them, Jack starts talking to him as they're about to eat. And Leonidas starts with, strangers may become friends and allies. And Jack goes, and fighting can take all kinds of forms, right? Like hunting, like scavenging, like ambush. And these kids, they really work for you, right? Lots of folks out there not quite ready to knife a kid in the guts yet. No answer. Jack made sure his hand stayed comfortably on his MP5. So you asked us, and not because you're so damn friendly, but you thought that maybe you could take us down. Get, some nice shiny weapons, maybe some clothes, some fresh supplies. Don't blame you. Jack reached out and took the bowl from the girl who still knelt next to him. She looked shocked. He sniffed the contents and met Leonidas' stare. Yummy, how fast does it do the job? Silence. You could have heard a pin drop. Daniel shifted and frowned, clearly mystified by Leonidas. But Leonidas was tracking things perfectly. The old man reached out and took the bowl from him and handed it back to the girl. Put it away, he said to her. Be very careful. Jack, Daniel said, what's going on? These nice folks are pretty nonviolent. That doesn't mean they're not survivors, Daniel, Jack said. So what was it? Ground glass? Arsenic? So I just thought it was very awesome that he was on top of his game, where it seemed like Daniel was ready to eat and Jack was like, we need to, like, there's a reason these people are alive,
mm-hmm.
and they have all these supplies, and it's not because they're nice.
Yeah. It also makes it that much more mystifying that he eats the rape cake.
The rape cake, but also later in this book, when they get offered water by the dark company. Like, he just takes a handful to taste it. Like, what did you just learn?
And then, but don't they drink it first?
No.
No?
Oh, Jack drinks it first. Jack takes a small handful to taste it and then nods the rest of SG-1 like, this is cool. Except when Daniel and Sam are killing themselves with the holly leaves that were going to kill them, that Leonidas was going to use, it, like, works instantaneously.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Jess.
We'll blame it on the caller.
Jack thinks he's expendable. It's fine.
I know.
So
does Daniel.
That's fair.
Apparently, yes.
They all think they're expendable. Because Sam is also willing to kill herself before, like, man, they all just jump to suicide real quick is all I'm saying.
Do we give Sam and Daniel both a check for dying here?
Yes.
Do the books count?
Oh, do we? Do I need to write that down?
This is, I feel, another, like, Daniel death.
Okay.
All right. But also a Sam death.
I feel
like it counts. I mean, if we're counting it for Daniel Sarcophagus.
Count it.
Yeah, let's do it.
Counting it.
Mel, what do we have? What is Daniel at now?
Daniel's at 3 if we count this one.
Did we count the one in the movie?
Yes.
So he died in the movie? Water.
He died.
He didn't die in fire and water. He was presumed dead.
Well, they thought he was dead. Does that count?
He died in the Knox.
He died in the film, the Knox, and the book.
Okay.
We aren't counting presumed dead. We could do a separate list for presumed dead, maybe. I don't have
the time to do that list.
Mel, I'm glad you brought up that scene because I like that one of the phrases that Jack kind of uses and eventually applies to the rest, everyone on his team, is that he is genuinely proud to know this man.
Uh-huh.
And in that scene, after it's revealed that they were trying to kill them, the line says, Daniel was just figuring out how close a call he'd had. Jack saw the color drain out of his face, then surge back. Object lesson, Danny boy. Not everyone's your friend. And then Daniel looked down at the remains of the impromptu feast spread out before them, the hungry faces, and methodically tore open another MRE package and began offering what he had to the kids. There were times, Jack thought, when he was genuinely proud to know this man. I just love that.
So beautiful. I love
it. It is
moment.
Beautiful.
This book Daniel's to me
good.
Yeah, the book highlighted all the good Daniel bits. There yeah. I wasn't annoyed with Daniel once, even when he was like nothing
jumping into the line of
yes,
fire.
Yes, I didn't mind it cuz it was out of such, and this is just the benefit of books is that you're going to get more insight. Yeah. But man. And he says the same thing about Tilk, but I don't remember where he says it.
I will say though that because of this book, it makes me like see Daniel in a different light.
Me
in
too.
The early episodes.
Me too.
So therefore I'm not as annoyed when he like randomly runs out in front of people and is like, hey, we came from the Chapa Eye.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That's cool. And so
yeah, it gives some perspective.
It does, and I really appreciate that. So thank you.
Well, and there's also an exchange when he does it again that Sam goes, does he always do that? And Jack goes, yep. So speaking about Daniel, it talks about there's a moment where they're wandering through the maze and Daniel is just exploring and enjoying himself, kind of. And it sort of talks about how he may be facing death, but he is, quote, having the time of his life. And I don't know if you guys saw that. I cannot hear that phrase without thinking, and this is not related to Stargate at all.
Is it going
to
be the song?
No, no. Oh. This is during Denver Broncos head coach, the last head coach, Vance Joseph's first game. The poor guy, sideline reporter. Have you guys seen this clip?
Oh, yes.
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
This
so
is
this is Sergio Dipp on the sideline of a Broncos game talking about Vance Joseph's experience as a head coach.
It's a pleasure to be with you guys here on the field from up close, just watching Coach Vance Joseph from here. You watch him now on the screen. This diversity in his background is helping him a lot tonight. Quarterback at Colorado, defensive back in the NFL, and here he is. Having the time of his life.
Yikes.
It was so awkward.
Oh boy.
Having
it's not
the
good
time
of his life.
Right, like I said, I know it's not Stargate related, but no, I can't see that phrase anymore without
that's
thinking
okay
of Sergio Dipp.
And we're kind of bouncing around. We'll get back to the emails for a second. But also, I just opened my book and I noted that back to Shipper Goggles, Jack calls Sam his Carter.
Mm-hmm.
As after Carter gets out of the sarcophagus and she looks around dazed and blinked at them, where? And then she saw, he saw everything kick in fast, his Carter.
I definitely noted that.
Look, Melody, I see you giggling over there.
I can do whatever I want, okay?
Yeah, you can.
Yeah, so also also talking about what could be Shipper Goggles, but also maybe not Shipper Goggles, is Jack is having to consider as they're taking Daniel and Sam's dead bodies, which Daniel and Sam's dead bodies are being carried by two beefy white stone guys named Menelaus, and I'm going to pronounce it Philemon,
okay,
because Philemon is actually a family name in my family.
Oh, all right.
Like, my great-great-great-grandfather's name is Philemon.
Oh.
So, there you go. It's a book in the New Testament as well, because it's a Greek state that Paul wrote an epistle to.
Oh.
But yeah, so Philemon and Menelaus are carrying Sam and Daniel, and Jack has to consider, what if I only get one shot at the uh-huh sarcophagus? He says, what if it only works once? What if I can't save them both? Not really a choice. Carter first.
Yep.
Now, granted, he then goes on to talk about, well, because she's a good shot and she can fix the DHD. And I put, cold, hard decision. No other reason at all.
Yeah. Other than, yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure, Jack. Whatever you gotta tell yourself.
Yeah.
But it is interesting. I feel like one of the, we're sidebarring for a second, or one of the biggest, like, discussion points in their relationship is, like, we can't be together because of, like, military things and, like, what happens if we're put in a situation where, like, Jack has to choose? Well, like, they're not even together. And he chooses Sam, first of all, for very tactical reasons.
Very tactical. I mean, very real. Like,
those
I mean,
are
no, very
legitimate
reasons.
You're totally
reasons
right. They're legitimate reasons
so
to choose Sam.
No reason not to break the regs.
And I'm just saying, later on in the series, we find out that he chooses to save the SGC over Sam. So, I mean, choices have been made.
He's capable of making that decision. No, Jess, this is an argument that I've made every time that someone does the stupid, like, hero sacrifice. Don't give me this bullshit. Like, it doesn't change how compromised you are if you're in a relationship or not. You still love the person.
Right.
And also, like, everyone around you knows you're in love with them, so it's not like the gold and the bad guys can't already exploit that you care about your team. Mm-hmm. Like, and they probably know you like Carter the most, but they also know that Jack will do anything for his team. Like,
yeah. Like, it's like also that bullshit notion where it's like, oh, but like platonic love as well. Because if you had put, like, obviously for shipper reasons, I would love it if, like, Sam were put in danger or Jack was put in danger and the other had to, like, I don't know, go save them.
Save them?
Like, don't say, like, Abyss, but like Abyss. But that situation works with Teal'c and Jack, or Teal'c and Daniel. Like, it all works and doesn't Sam have to be shipped.
Yeah. Any combination of them.
Because they are a family and they love each other. It doesn't have to be romantic for it. Like, they're all fucking compromised, okay? That's true of, like, all military teams. Like, there's bonds there. I mean, that's a different discussion, I guess.
It is. But it's actually also funny because I just finished listening to the podcast about the sixth Harry Potter book, and Harry breaks up with Ginny, and it's like, Harry, that's bullshit.
Yeah.
Because as if Voldemort, he already has used Ginny against you, and she was just your brother's, your best friend's sister. Like, it doesn't matter. She's going to be in danger because of her association with you, whether you're banging her or not.
Well, and it's the same, like, in the seventh book, Harry Potter now, in the seventh book, when Harry tries to, like, sneak off and leave Hermione and Ron behind in an effort to, like, not put them in danger. It's like, sir. Literally everyone in the world knows, like, who they are to you. Like, that's not going to mean anything.
Yeah.
They, like, the Dursleys, fucking Harry is like, you gotta go because Voldemort's gonna torture the shit out of you because he thinks that I might come for you. Like, yes. Okay, that's not saving anybody.
Yeah. No, I always, when this stuff comes up, I always actually to myself, like, quote Ginny in my head when Harry goes to break up with her and she says, it's gonna be for some stupid noble reason.
Yeah. Anyways, back to Stargate.
Sorry.
I'm gonna pivot. So, one of Jackie's points was, and actually, this is a good question because I don't know the answer. So she says, if Artemis joined the hunt each night, were there two hunts going on? One, those with the darkened collars against the innocents, and two, Artemis and her Jaffa against whoever they could find?
I got the impression that Artemis was mostly just messing with people, like entertaining herself. And I think she wanted to make sure that they weren't becoming strong enough to take her on. So she would, like, go out and kill the Dark Company people who were marshaling some control. But I think mostly she's just bored. Like, she says that, like, she's bored on this planet after 1,000 years. She's just toying with people.
I kind of wonder too, like, why she even has Jaffa.
Where do they come from?
Like, where'd they come
from? She has a ship. She has a ship.
No, I know she has
a death glider.
Yeah. Well, a death glider is not, I meant more like Jaffa usually serve like a help me control my minions and keep. She's just chilling on this planet and people are delivering sacrifices to keep her game going. So, like, why does she need Jaffa? I guess she's a gold. They don't need a reason.
Well, and to protect her, because Jack is not the first person to try and go take her down.
Yeah. Jackie also asked, how did she tap into their minds and make Daniel view her as Share, which we can talk about because that's, a scene.
Oof, rough.
Or ensure Teal'c didn't hear her speaking to Jack. Jackie says, did I miss that explanation? Sam just seemed to blow up the console towards the end of the novel and nothing else was said about it.
I mean, I feel like I mean, we've kind of already discussed it. I feel like the necklaces, they weren't really like a mind control thing, but they allowed her to somehow manipulate what people could see or hear. How? I don't know. We're waving our hand at that. But yeah, I do feel like it was mostly the collars that allowed that to happen. As that's my answer for everything, it's the collars made them do it.
It's not super clear, like, what the collars are actually doing, I guess. Like, at least with, like, Broca Divide, there was some bullshit like, oh, it's increasing your testosterone or something. Like, at least, like, which is what's driving you to be more aggressive. Like, at least there's that. This is just like, okay, you've got a collar on, some people's collars are turning black and some are staying white. And then you also get, like, superpowers because they get to run really fast and be really strong and beat each other up and be really aggressive. Like, it's not clear. So I think the answer is it wasn't in the book. It's not super clear.
So it's a collar around their neck, and it's like injecting things into their spine.
Oh, there you go.
Oh, I was like, wow, did I miss a lot? I don't remember the end.
I do almost think they're almost like werewolves, though. Like, yes. Because they only, like, did this at night.
That's what Jack said, right? Jack.
Did someone say that?
Yeah, Jack says it's werewolf power.
Yeah. Oh, I missed that part.
Yeah. Also, man, now that I'm thinking about it, is this book just a BDSM book? There's collars. There's submission and dominance. There's, like...
Being tied up.
There's a lot of, like, trust issues.
So we've gone from Hunger Games to Twilight to 50 Shades of Grey?
This book is for everybody.
50 Shades of Grey is just Twilight fan fiction anyway.
So. And I'm saying, I'm pretty sure, was this written before Twilight?
Yes,
06.
Okay, so I mean, it's written before all three of them, guys.
Wait, was it written before Twilight?
I don't think so. I think
I looked up Hunger Games, not Twilight.
I read Twilight. Well, I think it came out my freshman year of high school, which would have been 06. So maybe it was about the same time.
05.
Okay.
Yeah, about the same time.
So yes, if you like any of those things, please check out this book.
This is going to be our episode synopsis. If you like Twilight, 50 Shades of Grey, and The Hunger Games, boy, do we have the book for you.
Oh, man. I feel like adding 50 Shades of Grey in there is like an insult, but that's just my opinion.
Look, she's the one who made them collars.
They could have been armbands.
It's they not could have been really armbands. 50 Shades of Grey.
It's not.
Unless, I mean, the word sir just, got brought
just up.
Okay. I'll just drink my drink. Okay, I'm going to put down Jackie's email. Jackie, you had a lot to say. This is all very good things.
So awesome. We loved what you had to say.
We pretty much agreed with you. Yeah.
We haven't brought up Lori. Sent us a little quick email.
Yes.
She said that she enjoyed most of all was that the characters and the character and the voice that the author represented was spot on.
Yes.
And that the reactions, thoughts, and speech patterns were, like, dead on the characters. And it was thrilling.
Yeah. And I agree. Like, I think that is probably my favorite thing about this book is that I really do think that she really nailed the characters. Voices very effectively.
I agree with that. I remember when I first started reading it, I immediately told Jess, I was like, these are like, it's like spot on. It's like watching an episode and it was great.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you think this would have translated well as an episode, or do you think this only would have worked as a book?
I think it would make a good episode, but I don't think they would have made it as an episode thematically. I think it is actually a little rough and mm-hmm. dark. I don't think they would have gone there. I don't think they would have wanted the visual of like Sam Carter almost killing a kid. I don't think we would have gotten fair. That.
That was pretty dark.
And also
suicide.
We can talk about it being a tactical decision they made, but Sam and Daniel committed suicide, and it's kind of like good choice, guys. Yeah. And
so, I feel like in the late 90s and early 2000s, it wouldn't have been made an episode. However, if Stargate was being made right now, I could see it becoming an episode.
Yeah.
Maybe, although maybe not after some of the backlash shows like 13's Reasons
Why. I mean, maybe not the suicide bit. Maybe not the suicide bit. Maybe they find some other way to get them to get the collars off.
Especially because the suicide bit, like, even though it was thinly veiled as tactical, there was also, like, Sam's reasons were pretty upfront of, like, I don't want to become this because I don't want to murder. I don't want to murder, and I certainly don't want to murder a child. So I feel like even though it was tactical, there was also, like, I'm biting the cyanide pill that's hidden in my back tooth, you know? Like, this is my way out.
Yep.
I did, though, I will say, I did, like, because you have the characters already, like you can see them physically in your brain.
Mm.
As I was reading it, I could see them kind of acting out the episode in my brain.
Yes.
So, like, seeing Amanda Tapping do all of this in the book was like absolutely amazing.
Yeah. Huh.
And so I would pay money for that.
Yes. Oh, I would like to see it. I'm not sure it would. I think it would make a good episode. I'm not sure it would get made.
Yes.
Okay, I agree with that, yes.
Multiple of the people who wrote into us mentioned that they were a little miffed or put off by, because when Daniel is kind of turning hunter, he observes Samuel, or Samuel.
Samuel?
Samuel? Oh, yes, Samuel.
No, I always call them Samuel. It's their ship name.
Oh,
no,
Jesus.
Stop that.
Daniel observes Sam. Yes. In a sexual light, somewhat, yes, frequently. And it's actually interesting because before he starts turning, he observes that he thinks of her eyebrow frown as undeniably cute.
Yeah.
So like we get a kind of the comparison point of like pre-corruption Daniel, where yeah, he notices that Sam is cute. Like he's married, he loves his wife, he's grieving, but he's also not blind, like, right. She's mm-hmm. cute, he notices it, but then as he becomes more and more hunter, his observations get a little more sexual. There's even a very like fanficky handsy moment where Sam is teaching him how to fire his pistol.
Yes.
And she's like adjusting him, and Jack kind of notices. Aww. It
Jack jealous definitely knows.
Jelly.
He thinks that he observes it as seeming against Regs, which is rich because I don't think there would be. I mean, they're on the same team. There might still be Regs governing them. Actually, I've looked it up. Consultants are considered, like, you're supposed to be cautious of relationships with consultants as well. Mm-hmm. So, but I did think it was funny. Like, Jack did get jealous of Sam getting handsy.
In terms of, like, Daniel, like, seeing Sam or talking about Sam, like, sexually, I mean, yes, I think there is a definite erotic undertone. I just looked at my book. I have a sticky note that just says UST on it.
Unresolved sexual tension?
Yeah. Hang on. I gotta know why I did that. Oh, he's looking at her collar. Nothing personal, Carter. He moved her hair off her neck and looked first at the unbroken skin. No stealth invasion by Goa'uld, at least. And then at the silvery mesh of the collar. He probed at it with his fingers, looking for some kind of catch. This close, it was impossible not to feel some discomfort. He compensated by focusing hard on the objective, the damn collar. She was breathing shallowly and fast.
Yeah, no, that's some...
I just have to put into context for everybody who hasn't read the book that Sam just tried to cut Jack's throat. So that's why this is all happening.
Yeah,
it's not just because Jack wants to touch her neck. Okay.
Yes. But I mean, it doesn't change the fact.
I was just giving people context.
Jack also gets, like, stabbed, not stabbed in the back, but a spear catches his tack vest.
Yeah.
Teal'c also gets a good slice in by Daniel. Like, this is a very violent book.
And, well,
like,
Daniel and Sam... gets rubble collapsed on top of him.
Yeah. And Daniel
gets
and Sam...
badly injured.
Yes. And the symbiote very much saves his life.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's a hell of a book. I just remember my thought. It was back to Daniel and Sam. I don't mind that it was, like, sexual, because to me it was all about, like, building up that, like, animalistic, like, hunting urge. It wasn't necessarily, like, oh, man, I want a boner. It's, like, I'm an animal, and, like, that's both my companion and my competition. Okay, go, Chels.
I agree. It is a little off. It feels a little out of place because, I mean, especially the three of us don't
ship
see that as a sexual dynamic yet.
No.
But I think in context, it's fine. No, I was going to say that there's one point where Jack goes out to pee and Artemis shows up behind him. And she's like kind of controlling him. And he turns around and he notes how beautiful she is. And then he compares her to Carter. And it's like he's saying she's about the same height as Carter.
Uh-huh.
But I'm just saying.
Uh-huh. Put the shipper goggles on. They're there.
But I also love, so in this scene, it's another just very Jack moment of he's wearing the collar so she can't, has some control over him. She orders him to kneel and he can't resist and he can't talk. Mm-hmm. But then she asks him questions so he has some capability to talk and he just gives her snark back. I mean, he calls her Goa'uld. He kind of lets her know that he knows what's up. He tells her that he killed Ra and she's next. it's great.
I love how much they brag about kicking Goa'uld ass in this book. Like, they mention it to, like, literally everyone they meet, like, killing gods ain't no thing. Like, we've done it a couple times.
Yep.
Which they have.
I mean, at this point they've only killed Ra, but
yeah. But yeah, that's, you kill one god, you killed them all, you know?
Is that how that works, really?
I don't know. They act like it.
Well, you've proven that you can.
Yes. And Tilk talks about that too, like, because they, when they are talking to the Dark Company, Tilk says Essios, which is the leader of the Dark Company, which is one of the hunter groups, says his men will escort us to the base of the hill and go before night falls. Jack says that's big of him considering we're fighting his war. And Tilk said, it's not easy to discard one's gods, especially those who walk among you. You did. I took 100 years, Tilk replied. And when I turned against Apophis, I still did not strike at him directly, only at my own kind. Do not judge them harshly. They are doing what they can. Jack says, yeah, killing each other instead of the enemy. Tilk is like kind of reminding Jack that it's not so easy, that like when you believe that is genuinely your god, or that is a god or goddess in this case, it's not so easy just to say, oh, we're going to go kill him and take him on. Like, it's not that easy.
Yeah. Again, I really felt like Jack was being very judgy of this guy who was truly just trying to make the best of a horrible situation. I mean, so, and he's like, oh, yeah, that's very generous of you. Essios tells them before that they've gone after Artemis once before and they took 50 men and came back with 20.
Right.
Like, yeah, he doesn't want to go risk 60% of his people again because they have a very tenuous grasp on keeping their little society running. And I just, like, I understood Jack's frustration, but I also was like, this dude is trying.
Yeah. And, like, it's not, and, like, they've been surviving for, like this for a few years now. They call it, like, the hunts, which they estimate to be about a year. And the longest surviving one was Leonidas at, like,
four seasons.
Four seasons. So, you know, it's not easy. This is not an easy lifestyle.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that y'all want to talk about? Like,
just some random thoughts I had. I thought it was interesting that Jack observed Hammond's command style as choose the best people and trust the hell out of them.
Yeah.
And probably kick their collective asses when they screw up. he also noted to himself as they were leaving that he should learn the name of the dude who opens and closes the iris, since he can basically turn them into splatter on the back of the iris, which I thought was a great little shout out to not knowing Harriman's name for a long time.
Oh, shall we talk about the fact that we find out what it was that Sam did on P?
I would like to talk about, because I
think, but Jack wasn't even there though. That's the whole problem. So,
Jack wasn't there, and it wasn't on that planet.
And Jackie pointed out in her email to us as well that that doesn't make sense. So
yeah, we agree with you, Jackie.
It doesn't, but it's really fine. It's okay.
I don't want her drunken indiscretion to be in the briefing room.
Yeah, I reject this completely.
No, hard no. Sam did not take her shirt off in the briefing room.
It doesn't even say she took her shirt off.
No, it doesn't. She just got up there and danced.
It says she got up on the table and...
It's more an emancipation that Jack says. Remember that time on P3X-595 when you took your... And she stopped him.
In the book, it just says she climbed up on the table. You're kidding. And, well, Daniel drew the word out to four syllables. I really don't think I should say. Jack was enchanted. Oh, now you know you have to say. Jack, come on, Daniel. A little star for entertainment here. Give. What happened? In typical Daniel fashion, he backed up and steered around the question. Tilk got her down, brought her to Doc Warner, and he gave her some kind of test. Turned out she had a specific reaction to some kind of fruit in the drink. He gave her a shot, and she was fine. Carter did something embarrassing, and I slept through it? Apparently. Please, God, tell me you're kidding. Would I do that? And that's literally it!
Yeah. So, it doesn't work because then that's so ridiculous of Jack to, like, be giving her shit about this in emancipation when he didn't even witness it.
No!
One. And two, it makes it so much worse to give her shit about it when it, like, it's one thing if it happened on a planet and it was between SG-1 and it was their little secret, but, like,
it happened in the debrief.
Like, yeah, we learned that, you know, Hammond isn't the kind of guy who's gonna hold something against you when it wasn't, you weren't in your right mind, but that could have legitimately had career-ending effects for her. Yeah, so I don't like that take that is what happened.
Yeah. And at the end of the book also, Daniel tells Jack that he made it clear that Sam and Daniel took the poison on their own and not by Jack's order. and that Doc Warner told them to talk to some kind of psychologist.
Yeah,
and Jack says, screw that. And Danielle says, when I said wants us to, it was really more of an order. And Jack said, not doing it. How about the four of us in a pitcher of beer instead?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, I appreciate that, and I know that's, like, how Jack operates, but no, seriously, please talk to somebody. You all need help. Please
make them go to a psychologist.
This is only season one. You're gonna need some help. Trust us.
Yeah.
Mel, anything else you want to add? Things that stuck out to you that we haven't covered?
No, we covered a good chunk of everything, I think.
It's hard to, like, I guess not go line by line by line, because there's so many great little throwaway moments. Like, honestly, if you're into team dynamics, and maybe you're not, you know, I know we're joking about the shipperiness of the book, but honestly, if you're just into, like, a solid SG-1 story, this is a really good jumping off. Like, I'm glad this was our first book, because I think this set us up for...
It was a very good team building book. Mm-hmm. It's a good, well-rounded team novel.
Yeah.
I don't know how the rest of the novels go. I don't know if they, like, split them up or what, but it was a good core four book together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and it gives us some great background. I mean, we get Sam spewing some of her background, but we also get observational background on Jack and Daniel and Teal'c, especially on Daniel, including Jack observing that Daniel flinches when people touch
him. Yes, that broke my heart. And multiple times we're reminded that Daniel has, like, taken beatings, gotten used to beatings.
Yeah.
Like, ugh. But Daniel doesn't flinch at Sam's touch.
Yeah, when she's helping him fire the pistol.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah, overall, it just, I do think it does great things. It characterizes them well. We get interesting dynamics and growth. Some conversations that I'm glad exist, like, somewhat in canon, that I would have loved to see them on screen, but it was really refreshing to read them anyway. Yeah, and I also actually kind of like that it ends with those people who had tried to make the best of a situation are now going to build their own society.
Yes.
On that planet. Mm-hmm.
They kind of get their everyone kind of gets their happily ever after. Like, they get rewarded for surviving, basically. Except for
Acton.
Well,
Leonidas.
What's her name? Iphigenia?
Iphigenia.
Iphigenia?
Yeah.
Except for her. Rough. Yeah, so Artemis hops on, so the Goa'uld Artemis hops on out of her original body because Teal'c staff blasts her in the stomach. And she snakes herself into this little girl. I mean, not little girl. She's a teenager.
16-year-old, yeah.
Yeah, 16. And she's basically, they can't kill her because it's this little boy's sister. Not a little boy. Again, he's teenage boy.
A young
boy. Sorry. They're all children to me.
His name is
Pilates. So old Pilates. anyways, but it's a sad story for them, I guess, because they're left on this planet. His sister is in a sarcophagus with a gold in her head.
We'll pretend they send the Tok'ra back.
Yeah. We're going to remember that they exist.
Headcanon.
Yeah.
They send the Tok'ra back to get the Asgard to go take her out.
But they can't get Ghouls out until Continuum. That's like...
Ten years?
Yeah, but the sarcophagus is like...
10 years from now.
Yeah.
Keeps them young and alive.
I'm just... Okay.
But no, they get it out in the... They get it out of Skara before that.
Oh, yeah. No, they don't.
No, they don't.
Yeah, they do. No. They take the Tok'ra out of... They take the Goa'uld out of Skara.
The Goa'uld stays in Skara.
Because Scar invited Sam and Jack to their wedding.
I remember now.
That's right. Yes. Okay.
Yeah. We'll cut that out. So I forgot about that.
Yeah. So one other thing that I just noticed in my notes. First of all, as I was reading it, I knew that Artemis was Iphigenia, and it was like,
I
was like yelling at my TV. I was like, you know, you guys, it's her.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And then, but so Jack and Carter have to go figure out how to turn off all the collars. And Carter, like, they walked in this room and Carter's like, this is overwhelming. And so she just blows the place up, which I love that that's, like, what she does. But you mentioned that when she comes out of the sarcophagus, he says fast, his Carter, what you, but then you left out that he says, nice to see you, Captain. And then he says, and that he does it straight faced when all he wanted to do was grin and whoop.
Yeah.
And then he sends her to find the DHD part and keep her eyes out for Iphigenia. And she says, you can count on me. And he says, yeah, getting that.
They're in love.
No, well, I mean, so, shipper goggles or not, it's a great moment of like,
it is.
This team is forming and she can count on him. She was willing, like, she was willing to basically commit suicide, trusting that Jack would bring her back. And Daniel was as well. And then she comes out of it and he immediately trusts her to get it done. And it's great. And it is a great married. Team dynamic book.
Can we also talk about real quick how before Iphigenia, is that her name?
Yeah,
that
Iphigenia.
Before Iphigenia went to the sarcophagus, she gave a snide comment to Daniel about finding Charé in the garden.
The gardens. Oh.
Yes.
Oh, gosh.
And so
shit's dark.
And so Daniel
warning again. Just
oh, yes.
Got to get rough.
Yes. Oh, yeah. So Daniel goes to this garden and Sam tries to stop him, like, you know, there's no point in going there, you know, whatever, whatever. They find out where the garden is, and it's just a whole mass of, like,
bodies.
Corpses.
Yeah. In various stages of decay.
Yes, yeah. And Daniel goes through every single one of them.
Not just Daniel, the Dark Company people.
Yeah,
and
the Dark Company, yes, okay, so,
help.
Yeah, so they all help.
And Leonidas was a real fucking dick.
He was.
He Leonidas, brought the kids!
He brought the kids, but then he says, blah, 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 blah. Where's the thing about him, about being
basically
a woman?
Says there's more fish in the sea to her, to
yeah.
him.
Yeah. One woman is very like another, he said, and looked at Daniel directly. Call her gone, boy, and move on. You can't spend your life staring at the dead. Sam's hand on his shoulder was all that kept him from going for Leonidas's throat, but then the gray misery closed in again, and there were bodies to move. Charé wasn't there. He didn't find her.
It's rough, but Sam stays with him.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Which is pretty beautiful. But yeah, and so Leonidas sucks. Essios and Briseis, they likened him to a trapdoor spider.
Yes.
Which I thought was, and but they were like talking about, we have this creature that like waits in, like, oh yeah, we have that too.
Yeah. Which I like that it's like, oh yeah, no, we have that. Like, even though there's things that are different, we don't have like a Stargate airport, but we all have like the trapdoor spiders.
Glad that's the thing that's universal. Yeah. But I also love, like, what a sore point this is for Daniel that he falls for that. Like,
yeah.
He knows, like, he even says in his head, like, logically, he knows Charé isn't there. He knows yeah. that, but he still cannot stop himself.
And also the fear he has that Artemis will be in Charé's body, because before they actually meet Artemis, he's terrified that he's eventually going to have to look into the eyes of his wife as a Goa'uld and have to make a decision.
Yeah, that's like the nightmares he's having the whole time they're on the planet revolve yeah. around like killing his wife being a Goa'uld, and then Artemis sexually assaults him.
Yeah.
Did we actually talk about that?
We
that
didn't.
Was, we she can. Pretends to be. We don't really have to, just we can note that Daniel
is sexually assaulted again.
Well, I mean, this is, I guess, technically before that, but yeah.
Daniel yeah.
gets sexually assaulted.
The first time.
By Artemis pretending to be his wife or making herself look like his wife.
The line is like he gags into the kiss or something like that. It's awful.
Well, mm-hmm. and then when they get back to the camp, he's washing his mouth out and Jack assumes he has blood in his mouth from like while Ugh. They were out hunting.
Yeah.
But it's not.
No. Ugh. Poor it's, Daniel.
Poor Daniel, guys.
Yeah. I liked, this has been my favorite version of Daniel so far, though.
Yeah.
Just because I feel like I learned more about him.
Yeah. At the end, Pilates stays to basically guard his sister's sarcophagus.
Yeah.
It gave me a bit of a Rory Pond vibe.
Yes. The boy who waited or whatever.
Yeah. Only it's his sister.
Only it's his sister. It's not, well,
not
it's,
his.
Love. I don't know. Who knows what things did in the Greek times. That's, I mean, essentially the book. Did we miss anything from the emails? I'm just making sure. Also, seriously, thank you, Jackie, Lori, Mary, and Kathy for emailing us your thoughts and feelings about the book. Y'all gave us great starting off points to get our own discussion going. And we super appreciate the fact that you even took the time out to read the book and then, like, let us know your thoughts. It's way more fun for us when we get emails like this. So thank you very much.
Yeah. Yeah. Mary did talk about how she had a problem with Artemis because she loves Artemis as her favorite Greek goddess. But it's like, she's not actually the Greek goddess Artemis. She's a goa'uld pretending to be Artemis. And also, Artemis did turn a dude into a stag and have his hunting dogs kill him. So all Greek gods and goddesses are problematic. Let's just...
Yes. Mary, if Artemis is your favorite Greek goddess, may I recommend the animated Hercules and Xena movie? Shut up. It's one of my favorite movies. Artemis in that particular movie is very good. It is still the image of Artemis who I have in my head to this day because it was very impressionable on young Jessica, who would not stop watching that movie. I love that movie to this day. It's wonderful. If you haven't seen it, it's very corny. And if you haven't seen Hercules and Xena, the regular shows, maybe you won't enjoy it as much. But if you like Artemis, that's a very good place to start.
Oh, I don't know if I want this in the podcast or not. But I just want to ask you guys, because there's a moment when they first get to Chalcis mm-hmm. or whatever, when mm-hmm. they're at the bar mm-hmm. and Jack observes, like, in his head, there's two things you have to know about off-world bars. And he's like, one, you need money. And then there's never a second thing. Am I crazy? Did anyone else notice that? What? Was that just Jack being that. Jack? That yeah. he's like, two things you need to know and then I'll only tell you one? Or was it just, it's towards the beginning. It's in chapter two, like when they're at the bar.
Two important things to learn about off-world bars. One, money was important. Daniel had managed to trade some kind of jewelry he'd brought along for the sake of history. Jack hoped it wasn't beads. For There's around. Not. Of local brew, Jack had specifically... Yeah.
Nope.
There's no second thing, right?
Nope, there isn't. I'm looking on the next page.
Stick so to canteens, maybe?
So do we think that that was, like a mistake that Julie made? Or was that just Jack being, like, Jack?
I mean, don't know. It's a stupid thing to say. I don't get it.
Like, I think it's a Jack thing to say because... Only he would say something like, there's two things to know about off-world bars, which I've never even been to one, saying in his own but head. I'm going to say this anyway.
But he's saying it as long as he's not saying it to anyone.
It's just in his head.
I don't know.
I would have been like, one, money was important, and two, money was important. Weird. I don't know. That's weird. Well, the author's note in the back says, anything screwed up in the course of the story is entirely the fault of the author, as she had excellent references, assistants, and genuine military types to tell her when she was in danger of going wrong, not to mention outstanding editorial help. Thanks for stepping through the Stargate with me. She also says, I love author's notes. Side note, if you're not reading your author's notes and your prologues and all your prefaces and your books, please start doing it. There's some great stuff in author's notes, and it kills me when I see people flipping past the author's notes section of books. Start reading them, please. But she says, some elements of the story are taken from Euripides' brilliant play, Iphigenia in Tauris, which Daniel is reading in the infirmary. Infirmary. Oh, boy.
Infirmary.
Woo! Infirmary. References to the team's visit to P3X-595 and to Captain Carter's removal of something can be found in the SG-1 episode Emancipation.
Okay, so I will say I do... Yeah, no, I agree with you guys that it should have happened on the planet, not yes. in the briefing room.
I don't want Hammond to see Sam removing ... something.
Yeah, that's why there's Sam and Hammond fanfic, Jess.
I know! That's why it exists. My eyeballs can't unsee it.
It's Julie's fault. That's why it exists.
Okay, so that's basically the book. I think we covered our thoughts and feelings.
Are we gonna rate it?
Yeah, let's go ahead and let's do it out of chevrons like we normally do. Although this is like new territory, so
yeah, it's tricky because it's also the only one I've read.
It's the only one I've read. I feel like
I'm gonna give it a 5.
I was gonna go 5 as well.
I'm gonna give it a 5.
Twinsies.
Because like I said, like the voices were there. It felt like an episode of Stargate. It was great. The team bonding was great. It was dark. I kind of liked that it was dark.
Me too.
Just because it was a little different than the show. But yeah, I'm going to give it a 5.
I'm changing my mind. I'm going to give it a 6. But I'm trying to think of, like, why I would dock it. And I think there's some confusion about, like, I wish the collars were more clearly explained. And I wish Artemis's, like, you know how all the gold have, like, master plans of some description or, like, end games, ultimate goals? I wish that was a little more clear. I take it back. I don't mind that the collars weren't that clear because I like a good open-ended interpretation. They offer enough that you can make your own decision. But yeah, all the things that we already said. I like the shippy, to me, moments between Jack and Sam. I like the overall team dynamic. I like that this book made me really like Daniel. I like that it's Jack's picture on the spine. I'm a big fan of all those things. I also appreciate that the color scheme on the cover is purple. These are all working for me. I would happily reread this book and or see it adapted into an episode. So I'll give it a 6 out of 7, but with the preface that this is only my second Stargate novel that I've ever read. So,
and that's why I gave it a 5, because it's the only Stargate novel I've read, and I don't want
to, like... You're lowballing yourself.
I don't want to, like, go too far off the ledge.
Yeah, yeah, I don't know how it'll compare to other ones. I really am struggling with how to rate this, because overall, I really enjoyed reading it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I'm going to give it a 5, because I did have struggles. Well, first of all, especially because it's the end, so it's the thing that, like, is sitting in your head, as I not like the drunk Sam on the briefing room table. I'm just not okay with it.
Maybe I'm bringing it back down to a 5. Y'all are convincing me.
But like I said, overall, I enjoyed reading it. I loved the team dynamics. I love getting some of those moments that I've been begging for. Like, as we've been reviewing the first season, I'm like, where are these moments? And so I loved getting those moments. I do think that there are some little plot holes and inconsistencies. Nothing so glaring that it really took me out of the story.
Yeah.
But I did have moments of being like, wait, what now? But I also want to give it bonus points for being honestly truly well researched, like all of the Greek background, and they had, you know, we had Greek names for everything, the different types of tunics, and, you know, having Daniel being like, oh, now we're in this part of the town, and this is the, you know, this is the Agora, and this is the Stoa, and this is the Bouletari, like all the cool Greek names for things. So I want to give props for that as well. So yeah, I think 5. It's a good book. I think it has some issues. It is a little troubling that we have our team committing suicide.
Yeah.
But, you know, it works out, so.
Are we going to give Airmail award?
Yeah.
Who shall we give it to? I kind of want to give it to...
I don't know.
Jack? I feel like I have... Oh, see, I was going to give it to Daniel or Sam.
I wanted to give it to Sam.
Because they controlled themselves.
But then again, I want to...
But so did... SEOs fucking kept an entire civilization group together. Like, a pretty large group.
Yeah.
Can they all have it? They all did good. Except Leonidas. Yeah,
I can't pick one. Because, like, Jack also got their asses back to life.
Yeah.
With and his bum ankle.
Teal'c did the killing shot to Artemis.
Yes. Teal'c was a badass. Mm. Yeah,
one gets an Air Medal Award. They're all great.
Never mind. We're not doing it. We're not doing it.
You get an Air Medal Award, and you get an Air Medal Award, and you get an Air Medal Award.
Yeah, so that was our first book club episode. We did it. Obviously, this was our first episode, so let us know if this was, like, too all over the place for you, if you want more structure, less structure, if this was just fine, if you would never, ever want to listen to an episode like this again. That's cool, too. We're open to suggestions. We are closing and wrapping up our first season of SG-1 episodes, which is very exciting. We've got a couple more in the bag, and then we'll be starting in season 2. All that to say, if you read Sacrifice Moon and you didn't email us before this episode came out and you've since read it, or you didn't read it at all and you want to know what the fuck we're talking about, or you have questions, whatever it is, maybe you just want to come say hi. You can email us at chevronslock7@gmail.com, or you can tweet us at chevronslock7. You can also tweet me, Jess, at on Twitter at Prof Tennant, or you can find me on Tumblr at Professor Tennant.
You can find me, Melanie, on Twitter at Melanie Martian, M-A-R-S-H-A-N, or you can find me on Tumblr at My Stupid Dumb Flyboy.
You can find me, Chelsea, on Tumblr at Pianosa 2 to the Fighting Eighth, or on Twitter at Cahills.
And this is not an episode, so we don't have clips to close it, so we'll see you next time.
I almost started humming the Doctor Who theme because for some reason that was in my brain and I don't know why.
I'll take it.
I did say that the boy who waited. I talked about Roy Pond.
There's very Doctor Who-y. I wonder if Rachel Kane's a Doctor Who fan.